The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk. This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at weightwatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. When the shooting and the shouting were over, no one who saw it could believe what they had seen. The afternoon encounter had been brief. The time from the first shot and the drive away took less than 30 seconds. More than a few had watched it unfold. Many of those had been children who had been playing in the park across the street from their modest homes. It was not the ritziest of neighborhoods. In fact, the houses along Braybrook Street were government issue, something the British called council houses. We would know them on this side of the pond as good and solid public housing, nice enough for families who had low or unstable incomes but could afford the below-market rent. The park was named for nearby Wormwood Scrubs, the foreboding prison set in the heart of Shepherd's Bush, a community in West London. The prison had a 20-foot-high wall, which somehow was still occasionally scaled by men shimmying their way down to waiting getaway cars idling in the alley. The police knew this and often surveyed the area for any kind of suspicious activity. It was just part of the full life of 1966 post-war England. By then, the Beatles were, per John Lennon's March statement to the Evening Standard, more popular than Jesus. Barclays Bank issued the first British credit card, and executions as a penalty for murder had just been suspended by a parliamentary act after a few high-profile wrongful executions shook the populace. The British were becoming increasingly convinced that state-sanctioned murder was not an effective deterrent to crime. It was also, they believed, morally indefensible. Dr. Liz Yardley, a British criminologist, dissects the decade in that country.
I think there was an interesting dichotomy going on in the 1960s. So you've got quite grinding poverty in the post-war years, people kind of adapting back to normal everyday life after quite a turbulent period. But at the same time, you've got quite a lot of innovation going on, particularly in terms of fashion, in terms of music and popular culture. And England won the World Cup in 1966. So you've got this almost kind of bipolar society at that time.
Which meant that innocence and naivety lived alongside darkness and violence. These forces met that day on Braybrook Street when three plainclothes cops from the Metropolitan Police's Shepherd's Bush station were shot and killed in broad daylight. When the world, as the British knew it, would change, when the modern world was forced upon them, and they would have to choose whether or not to flinch. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hims. All right, let's take a break from talking about historical crimes and talk about something more modern, taking care of your health.
Specifically, something a lot of guys deal with but don't always love bringing up, erectile dysfunction.
It's actually much more common than people think. And the good news is getting treatment is easier than ever. Through Hims, you can access personalized prescription treatment options for ED if prescribed, all online.
Which means you don't have to schedule awkward appointments or sit around in a waiting room hoping nobody recognizes you.
Exactly. Hims connects you with licensed providers online so you can get expert care on your terms.
They offer access to ED treatment options ranging from personalized products to trusted generics that cost 95% less than brand names if prescribed.
It's basically a digital front door to getting back to feeling like yourself again, with medical providers helping make sure you get treatment that actually fits your goals. To get simple online access to personalized, affordable care for ED, hair loss, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/COTC.
That's hims.com/COTC for your free online visit, hims.com/COTC.
Feature products include compounded drug products, which the FDA doesn't approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. See website for details, restrictions, and important safety information. Actual price will depend on product and subscription plan.
The Shepherd's Bush murders are often referred to as a massacre. The British newspapers employed the term liberally in headlines in the days and months that followed. And in fairness, it was and is an apt term because what happened that day was nothing less than an execution, indiscriminate and brutal. Nothing about that day, August 12, 1966, forewarned the death of three policemen and the beginning of one of the largest manhunts in British history. It was hot and humid, predictable conditions for August in London. Three Metro London police based at the Shepherd's Bush station, each in a coat and tie, got into an unmarked blue Triumph 2000, one of only a handful of cars equipped with a police radio to communicate with headquarters, to patrol the streets on their regular 9-to-5 shift. Temporary Detective Constable David Woomble was just 25. He had a wife, Jillian, and a young son and daughter. Detective Sergeant Christopher Head was 30 and unmarried. Police Constable Jeffrey Fox was the veteran cop, the guy in charge. He was 41 and had three children with his wife, Marjorie. Known for his comprehensive knowledge of the area he patrolled, it was said that he never forgot a face, especially the ones that were up to no good. At the time, Jean Cooper was a WPC, a woman police constable, stationed at Shepherd's Bush. She's now a retired chief superintendent of police. She remembers all three men.
Jeff Fox was one of the characters of the police station. He served all his police service there, so he knew everybody.
Chris Head, he was from Devon. I didn't know him so well because he'd only recently come over from Hammersmith, but a very nice guy. Dave Woomore was a much younger man, and he was also a temporary detective, so he'd been selected for that. A very smart, personable, really nice young man.
Fox's familiarity with the landscape, of course, made him intensely valuable when law enforcement was set on stopping anything from happening before it did. He could interrupt the sheerest beginnings of shenanigans and make the bad guys think a little harder about going ahead. The young men were there to learn from the pro. The three of them made a good team. They had each other's backs, though that would prove to be of little use that day because they carried no weapons. They didn't even have a pair of handcuffs on them. Beat cops had little more. They were allowed to carry a whistle and a truncheon. They had no radio, just the knowledge that a police call box was nearby. The whistle was to be blown three times in rapid succession if they needed help from any other cop in the vicinity. It was assumed the public would also offer some help should they get into trouble. And this was true even as London grew to be, in 1966, a city of more than 7 million people. When the Metropolitan Police were first established in 1829, senior officers were allowed to carry pocket pistols. Larger firearms were provided if circumstances arose where they knew they were going to be responding to armed criminals. But in 1936, it was determined that carrying guns was unnecessary, even when policing in outlying districts. Firearms were for those specially trained for only the most dire of encounters. This sounds so very foreign to me as an American. Mike Waldron, a British police officer and firearms expert, explained.
It was quite unusual for criminals to get hold of guns and use them in the 1960s. Those that were available were usually war souvenirs that had been brought back after the Second World War. When they were stolen and ended up in criminals' hands, the person from whom it was stolen is not likely to want to report it because they get into trouble for having it in the first place. So mainly it was ex-war souvenirs that were in the hands of criminals at the time, but it was still quite rare.
That also sounds foreign, almost quaint even. Anyway, one of those who collected guns on the black market was a 30-year-old career criminal named Harry Roberts. He hadn't had much of a chance to be anything but. He learned to steal from his mother, who purloined, then sold, things like sugar and ration books during the Second World War. He had served some time when he was in his late teens before being called up to serve by the British military in 1956 in Malaya. He was said to be a good soldier, though he often boasted about how easy it was for him to kill. He took the training seriously. The Malayan Emergency, as it was called, began in 1948 and was also known as the Anti-British National Liberation War. Those who served were taught how to handle a variety of weapons and how to survive in the roughest of conditions. Roberts and his cohorts put such training to good use in the Malayan jungles. On August 12, 1966, hidden under overalls in a canvas bag, Roberts carried with him three guns, a 25-year-old 38 Enfield service revolver, a 35-year-old 38 Colt Special, and a 9mm Luger P08, a toggle-loaded, recoil-operated semi-automatic pistol that was German-made sometime between 1898 and 1949. It was a Nazi favorite, though not exactly state-of-the-art in 1966. With him that day were two mates Roberts had recently met in a pub. Together, they had concocted a scheme which first required them to steal some cars. They met that August morning and set out in a tatty blue 12-year-old Standard Vanguard, a British-made sedan. It belonged to Jack Whitney, a 36-year-old petty criminal, a man who had 10 convictions to his name, all involving theft. He had a wife who thought he had gone to work that day, not knowing that he had actually been unemployed for a few months already and was only pretending to go to work. Whitney would be the driver that day. With them, confined to the back seat of the Vanguard, was John Duddy, a 38-year-old truck driver who had led a bit of a dodgy life, stealing occasionally when he was younger. He had been doing pretty well at keeping his nose clean as an adult until, that is, he started to drink too heavily. Maybe that was due to his fresh marital problems. His wife had taken off with two of his younger daughters just 2.5 weeks before, leaving him to take care of his two older daughters. Those teenage girls worked to keep food on their dad's table. They hadn't heard from their mom since she took off after a bad argument with her father. The original plan had been, well, if you believe the story one of them told later, to steal three cars that day. The cars were needed because they had schemed up a much larger heist at an engineering and manufacturing complex in nearby Northolt. God knows why, but they were very specific in their search, looking for two Jaguars and a Ford Executive, a luxury American-made vehicle. Still, on hand in the rundown Vanguard that day was a single fake license plate. The fake plate had been made in advance to match the registration number of a specific car they planned to use, a new dark blue Ford Corsair. The trio decided to cruise an area near the prison where they knew commuters often left their cars parked before riding a bus or the tube into town. They were nicely dressed. This way, they would look like businessmen huddled around their own cars, chatting while doing their nefarious business. And they could rest easy, knowing that any theft wouldn't be noticed until early evening. By then, they'd be long gone. They found a dark blue Corsair early that afternoon. Whitney was given the job of jimmying the lock with a wire tool. Roberts was providing him with a bit of cover. It was going pretty well, no one had seen them, when the wire broke and got stuck in the lock. A none too pleased Harry Roberts, who was calling the shots, told them to forget this car. They needed some lunch and a pint to get through the sweltering afternoon. The three cops also stopped their patrolling for lunch. It had been an ordinary morning, nothing to report. Both cars were back combing the streets by 2. Around 3, the cops must have spotted the rundown car carrying three men who appeared to be scouting out the neighborhood. Later, his co-workers would speculate that Jeff Fox had likely recognized Whitney, who was driving the car. Or maybe one of the cops had noticed the car had no tax disc affixed to it per driving requirement. The Triumph 2000 followed the Vanguard a little bit before Roberts or Whitney noticed. The Vanguard turned onto Braybrook Street to see if maybe the Triumph would follow. It did, taking the opportunity on the suburban street to pull up alongside. D.S. Chris Head waved for them to pull over. They did so in front of number 57. The Triumph drove ahead and stopped at an angle 130 or so feet ahead of them. D.C. Womwell got out of the Triumph to speak to the driver, as he would for any routine traffic stop. He had a pencil and pad in his hands. He asked for the driver's license and insurance. He asked about the missing tax disc. Whitney explained that he'd already been pulled over once that week for the missing disc, which was true, and that he hadn't had time to do the paperwork to fix the problem. He asked if the cop might give him a break on that. That's when Womwell noticed that Whitney's insurance had just expired all of 3 hours earlier at noon. Womwell went to speak to Fox, his superior officer, to see what he should do next. While they chatted, a quiet panic seized the would-be car thieves. Harry Roberts decided to reach into the canvas bag that was placed between himself and Whitney on the front seat. He put the loaded Luger inside his jacket. By then, Officer Womwell was on his way back to Whitney. Head got out of the car as well to see if he could help. He went to the passenger side and tried to open the door, which he found to be locked, while Womwell resumed his chat with Whitney. Roberts, who was seated next to the door, made no move to unlock it. Womwell asked to see what was in the canvas bag. Harry Roberts' patience had come to an end. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Home Chef. You know those nights where you're staring into the fridge hoping dinner will magically appear?
Yeah, that's basically every night in our house.
Which is exactly why I like Home Chef. Amanda Rossman does too, by the way.
I caught she said that when we met up for your live performance the other night.
She did. Home Chef is rated number one by users of other meal kits for quality, convenience, value, taste, and recipe ease, which makes sense once you try it.
I also like that they have different levels of effort depending on the day. Sometimes we've cooked the full recipe. Sometimes it's one of those oven ready trays.
They also do chef-inspired recipes. They've worked with chefs like Gordon Ramsay and now Giada De Laurentiis. So it feels a little fancy even when you're just cooking at home.
Exactly. And it helps keep the grocery bill under control too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. For a limited time, Home Chef is offering our listeners 50% off and free shipping for your first box plus free dessert for life. Go to homechef.com/COTC. That's homechef.com/COTC for 50% off your first box plus free dessert for life.
Homechef.com/COTC. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert. The children on the playground nearby initially thought that someone must be filming a movie, because this was not ordinary fare on a suburban street in working-class London. They watched as a man in the front seat leaned toward the driver's side window and shot what looked like a plainclothes cop in the face. The bullet pierced his left eye, then exited his skull, causing him to fall backward onto the pavement, dead before he reached it. He was still holding the pad and pencil. That's when they saw another officer, the one on the left side, turn to run back to the car that was blocking the other's exit. He was yelling, "No, no, no," when he was shot in the back, causing him to fall forward. The man that everyone in England would soon recognize as Harry Roberts then got out of the car to shoot him again. The man on the ground had enough strength to kick Roberts, who caught the man's leg and held it as he put the gun inches from his face to shoot again. But the bad guy's gun jammed, and the guy on the ground tried to scramble away, only to find that Roberts was on him again. The cop kicked him again in the face, bloodying his nose. Furious at this turn of events, Roberts shot again, and the Luger jammed again. PC Fox had moved into the driver's seat by now and was trying to back over Roberts to keep him from firing again. He didn't know that Roberts had told Duddy to grab another gun until he felt a bullet graze his chin. It must have startled him, but only briefly, as a second bullet didn't miss. It hit Fox in the right temple. He crumpled onto the steering wheel, already dead, his foot still pressing on the gas. The car rolled over DS head, wedging him so that the muffler seared the flesh of the bleeding, dying man. The three bad guys rushed back to the Vanguard and drove away. Whitney and Duddy had not expected this day to go this wrong. Roberts told them to shut up or they'd be dead too. Onlookers, people who had been walking their dogs or watering their lawns, immediately moved to help those lying in the street. Realizing there was nothing they could do, they grabbed blankets from their houses to cover the men. They called the Shepherd's Bush Station for help. A nearby unit got the call from headquarters. Raybrook Street, near the prison, Sirius GBH. Ambulance called, vehicle concerned, blue Vanguard with PNJ and index number, direction unknown. No further particulars. GBH is cop speak for grievous bodily harm. Help began arriving at 3:22 p.m., only to find their colleagues on the ground, in and under the Triumph. The officer in charge decided to borrow a neighbor's home phone to call to convey the worst to those back at the station. It was too horrible to broadcast to those on the street who had radios. Within the hour, WPC Cooper was given the awful task of informing the next of kin. She had done this kind of work before.
We called them death messages. We used to have messages where you had to tell relatives that their loved one had had a heart attack or been killed in a road traffic accident. And it's always exceedingly difficult. The first thing you have to do is to not frighten the life out of them. Get into the house so that they don't collapse and shut the door on you and be unconscious on the inside. And then you have to make sure that they're okay and there's someone to care for them.
But this was different. She changed out of her uniform, put on fresh clothes, and began to make the rounds.
So I'd been to see the Foxes, and then I went on to see Gillian Woolmore, David's wife. And she was a very, very young wife with two small children. Although we broke the news to her, she was already in a kind of daze because I think one of our colleagues had been up there first. So that was a terrible thing to have to do, and it was a terrible thing for both families. And, of course, Chris Head's family as well, all three. You never forget that you've done it. And you never forget the sadness that it brings to absolutely everybody.
Meanwhile, Roberts, Whitney, and Duddy drove to the garage where they had rented a space to park what they had hoped to steal that day. Whitney made sure the Vanguard's license plate was obscured, then locked everything up tight. The men, thoroughly spooked, spoke about what to do next. Roberts said they needed money and they would have to rob a bank now. Duddy told him he had lost his mind. So instead, they decided to split up. If there was anything to be grateful for that day, it was this. One of the onlookers walking to the park with his wife that day had the presence of mind to take down the full license plate number of the Vanguard, PGT-726. By the time police got this information, it was just past 5 p.m., on a Friday, no less. Police ordered all of London's now-closed records vaults opened and every available officer, man or woman, be put to manually hunting down the owner history of this vehicle. By 8:30, the police were on their way to the last known owner of the car. The records, however, hadn't been kept up to date, so Scotland Yard moved from one owner to the next with lightning speed, tracking the vehicle. It said that by 9 p.m., they were in front of John Whitney's basement flat His wife came to the door and called for her husband to join her so he could answer these men's questions. They asked him where he was that afternoon. He said he was at the betting shop at the time of the shooting. When asked about the car, he told them he had sold it. This was news to his wife, who was already standing there aghast because he had obviously lied to her about being at work. She was fit to be tied now that she learned he had sold their car, too. The police told her to please calm down. They had bigger fish to fry. They took Whitney into custody for further questioning. He stuck firmly to the story. But it was unraveling. That Saturday night, the missing car was found in the public garage and his betting shop alibi fell apart. Inside the Vanguard, police found spent pistol cartridges. Then a few witnesses from Braybrook Street sealed his fate by positively identifying him. Noted UK-based criminologist Judith Robitum explains what happened just past midnight on Monday, August 15th.
Whitney fairly well decided he was in for it. He was not going to be able to get out of this. And above all, his best way forward was to confess and to implicate his accomplices, insisting all the time that he had been the driver, only the driver, that he had had no knowledge of Harry Roberts' intention, was taken by surprise.
His formal statement began, quote, "As God is my judge, I had absolutely nothing to do with the shooting of any one of the three police officers, as no doubt witnesses can testify," end quote. But yes, he was there. He gave the cops the names of those who had pulled the triggers. He told them about the plan to steal cars, the plan to rob the factory, everything he knew. He wanted this all to go away. It wasn't about to. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hiya Health. Parenting involves a lot of negotiations, bedtime negotiations, screen time negotiations, and the classic, the vegetable negotiations.
Vegetable negotiations can be intense.
Which is one reason I like Hiya. Their kids' vitamins are designed to fill in the nutritional gaps a lot of kids end up with without turning the vitamin into candy.
Yeah, some kids' vitamins have a surprising amount of sugar and artificial stuff.
Hiya took the opposite approach. Zero sugar, no gummy additives, and a really clean ingredient list. Non-GMO, vegan, dairy-free, nut-free. They also work with pediatricians and nutrition scientists and test their products for heavy metals and contaminants.
And here's something every parent needs to hear. If getting your kids to eat vegetables feels like an impossible daily battle, Hiya Kids Daily Greens plus Superfoods is a total game changer. It's basically chocolate milk stuffed with veggies. It's a greens powder that's packed with 55 plus whole food sourced ingredients. Just mix one scoop with milk or milk alternative and watch them actually enjoy something that's secretly fueling their growing body.
Now, we've worked out a special deal with Hiya for the best-selling children's vitamin. Receive 50% off your first order. To claim this deal, you must go to hiyahealth.com/COTC. This deal is not available on their regular website. Go to hiyahealth.com/COTC and get your kids the full body nourishment they need to grow into healthy adults. There was no bigger story in Britain and wouldn't be for a long while. The rest of the world, even the parts more inured to gun violence, was no less horrified by the death of three unarmed police. The New York Times put the killings prominently on the front page, as did dozens of smaller American papers. And the next day's London Daily Mirror, the headline read, "Massacred in the largest type possible." Then, in only slightly smaller type, in the line of duty. The nation had one duty now, to find those who did this. The paper reported that, as of Saturday morning, 18,000 people were officially looking. That included the British Army's Royal Armored Corps, a combat arm of the nation's military, police officers from around the country who were choosing to use their vacation time to search, local business people, and even the Boy Scouts. Authorities would later acknowledge that early reporting was flawed, with so many people scrambling for fresh information, making it difficult to know how many were actively searching or what intelligence they were acting on. What mattered most to police, though, was that the media were broadcasting the make, model, and license plate of the car the three gunmen had fled in. And they were indeed. Duddy had, by now, fled to Glasgow, where his father had once been a police officer. But the news was everywhere, and by Wednesday, the 17th, he was back in London, in custody, saying that he, too, had not killed anyone. I'm not sure what caused the delay, probably the ongoing investigation and the logistics of coordinating such a massive state funeral, but on September 1st, 1966, 3 weeks after they had been gunned down, the three fallen soldiers were laid to rest. 600 police officers lined the route to Westminster Abbey for the mass funeral. Those paying their respects included Prime Minister Harold Wilson and members of both parties in Parliament. Just FYI, the Queen did not attend, per long-standing royal protocol that the monarch rarely attends the funerals of those not in his or her family. This explains as well her lack of attendance at the funeral 3 years earlier of the assassinated President Kennedy. But she, like millions of others, likely witnessed it via newsreel or television broadcast. Here's some audio from a British Pathé newsreel that was filmed so that moviegoers without television access could witness the proceedings.
Upon St. Stephen's Church focused the heartfelt sympathy of all the nation. For here, with a congregation of police and relatives, was held the funeral service of the three men who were shot dead, callously murdered, barely a mile from here. They were protecting the public in the execution of their duty. That stark official phrase, invested now with deepest sorrow.
The reel shows the crowds that gathered in the streets and rows upon rows of police officers who attended the solemn rites. The Daily Mirror put £1,000 in the fund, as did its sister paper, the Sunday Mirror. My handy British inflation calculator tells me that's a gift of about £25,000 in spending capital today from each paper, which is just shy of $34,000 in American money. Another early donor was a holiday camp owner who anonymously gave £100,000 to the effort. That behest would account for almost £2.4 million today. As significant, every one of London's police officers put a day's pay into the fund. Meanwhile, a very wanted Harry Roberts wended his way through London, visiting with a lady friend, then made his way to Hertfordshire, north of London, and into the underbrush of Thawley Wood. The British media stayed on the story, prominently printing a photograph of the missing Harry Roberts that almost filled the front page on Thursday the 16th to help aid the average man on the street should they run into him. The headline was as straightforward as they come. This is Harry Roberts. The public was cautioned to keep an eye out. He could be anywhere. The police, for their part, chased down even the weakest of tips, leading them to search entire forests and every Soho strip club. They mined Robert's friends and family for bits of information in hopes of deciphering where he had gone. They even arranged for Robert's mother, Dorothy, to appeal to her son to turn himself in.
I ask you from the bottom of my heart to come into the open and give yourself up. If you make an appointment with me, I will come with you. The whole thing is killing me. Please do as I ask you before there's any more bloodshed.
Roberts had a transistor radio with him in the woods, so he may have heard the plea. If so, he didn't heed it. While he was on the lam, the gears of justice turned against Duddy and Whitney, who were doing all they could to help find Roberts in an attempt to perhaps lighten their own inevitable sentences. In Nick Russell Pavier's book, The Shepherd's Bush Murders, he wrote that Roberts, quote, remained in the woods and only ventured out at night. His isolated routine became almost an exercise in self-hypnosis. At times, he forgot why he was there. It was tempting to think the world had forgotten about him. He discovered a nearby poultry farm and local allotments, which supplied him with plenty of food, and he would sit quite content by his fire, talking to himself and daydreaming in a secret world all of his own making, end quote. In early November, police learned of some robberies in and around Thollywood. As they investigated, they soon heard about how smoke had occasionally been spotted wafting from a remote part of the wood. Some people said they had seen a rough camp assembled back there as well. Very early on Saturday, November 12th, we're talking around 3 a.m., Detective Sergeant Thomas O'Connor of the Hertfordshire Constabulary, along with some other officers, found the unoccupied camp. Inside the tent were the types of things you would expect in an encampment, food preparation tools, and an assortment of tinned food. But then there were 30 rounds of what appeared to O'Connor to be ammunition for a .38 revolver, as well as one round for another kind of weapon. He also found a holster that could hold two such weapons. The officers tagged and bagged as much as they could, specifically taking a pillbox of some kind in hopes of obtaining a fingerprint from it. It turned out Roberts had been scared off earlier in the day by a policeman and his dog scouring the area. He spent the night in an unused airplane hangar, which doubled as a barn for storing hay. After sunrise, more police arrived to fully investigate the campsite. They found gin and tonic water, as well as some scotch, some toilet tissue, and a tea strainer. On Monday, November 14th, the trial of Whitney and Duddy began. It was abruptly stopped when word came that authorities were close to nabbing their missing accomplice. By now, hundreds of police were on site in Thollywood, methodically combing it for the gunman. He was found sleeping in the barn, alongside the Luger, a flashlight, and some liquor. When asked if he was Harry Roberts, he reportedly replied, quote, "Yes, you won't get any trouble from me. I've had enough," end quote. He had been on the run for 96 days. He asked to make a statement. In it, he said he had killed two policemen and that John Duddy had killed the third. Later, in court, both Duddy and Whitney pleaded not guilty to the full 11-count charge against them. They had decided to take their chances, arguing that they had only been accessories after the fact. Harry Roberts pleaded guilty to all of it. The 6-day trial racked up a mountain of testimony and a wide range of exhibits. Still, it took only 40 minutes for the jury to find all three guilty on every count. They each received a life sentence with a minimum of 30 years before they could be paroled. A 10-year sentence for possessing firearms with intent to cause harm was to run concurrently for each as well. It was assumed they would die in prison, which was actually a lucky break for them. Had the trio been convicted just 1 year earlier of the same crimes, they would have all been hanged. The so-called Murder Act had suspended capital punishment just 8 months earlier, in November 1965. The public wasn't altogether pleased that they were not going to be executed. Many, if not most, thought this was a prime example of why the country needed a death penalty. They were vocal in saying so. But that was not the only issue that had been shaken off the tree subsequent to the massacre. This is a headline in the Daily Telegraph from Monday, August 15th, just 3 days after the killings. "Do not arm police," says Yard Chief. Scotland Yard Superintendent Sir Joseph Simpson made his remarks while speaking to the BBC. He made it clear that the three deaths had not changed his mind about handing guns to his officers. He said that to do so would be a retrograde step that would make him, quote, "very, very sorry," end quote. In light of that, some Britons wondered, who on earth would want to sign up to serve? It was the time to arm officers, they said. This was the case that proved the necessity. Surely things had to change.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at WeightWatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Let's review a little history here. When the Second World War ended and the Labour Party returned to power, there was a growing call for abolition of the death penalty in Great Britain. The 1957 Homicide Act restricted its wholesale use in any murder to only specific kinds of murder, including that of a police officer. But in 1965, the Murder Act, which was also known as the Abolition of the Death Penalty Act, was given a sort of trial period of 5 years to see how it would work and how people would feel about it. The act, and the time restriction, was supported by all the major parties at the time. Then came Roberts, Duddy, and Whitney. The politicians held surprisingly firm. Here's criminologist Rowbottom again.
Had the Home Secretary wavered even a little, there could have been a revisiting, but he doesn't. He, supported by his fellow MPs, sticks to what they believe is a sound moral principle.
In 1969, the act was taken off its experimental track and made permanent. The death penalty was now limited to those who committed treason and piracy. In 1998, even those crimes could no longer be punishable by death. As for the issue of arming police, it remains controversial. Northern Ireland is the exception. Police there are routinely armed. But in England, Scotland, and Wales, it's a sticky wicket. First, I should answer a question I'm sure some of you have. How did Roberts, Duddy, and Whitney get 3 guns in the first place? In January 1967, a Greek Cypriot news agent named Christos Kostas stood trial for selling Roberts a German Luger and an Enfield revolver in early 1966, months before the Shepherd's Bush murders. Roberts testified at trial but denied ever meeting Kostas, claiming instead he had bought the guns from, quote, a man in South London, somewhere near the Old Kent Road, end quote. He refused to identify the man. The jury didn't believe him. They convicted Kostas on all counts, selling the 3 handguns, possessing weapons without a firearms certificate, and having a Colt pistol and ammunition at his Denmark Street shop in Westminster. The judge was blunt in sentencing him to 6 years. Quote, at your door, indirectly, lay the deaths of 3 courageous policemen, end quote. This is how guns entered the criminal underworld in 1960s Britain, not through legal channels, but through black market dealers who exploited the very system designed to keep weapons away from dangerous hands. And the Kostas case raises an uncomfortable question. If criminals could still get guns despite strict laws, shouldn't police be armed to protect themselves? It's a debate that flares up after every major incident. What history shows us is that after such things as the Shepherd's Bush killing, or more recently, organized bombings or attempted insurgencies, public support for arming the police increases. In fact, in 2017, after terrorist attacks in London and Manchester, a Sky News poll found 72% in favor of doing so. In less frenzied times, the number goes down. Daniel Smith, writing about British police gun policy in 2019, found that 90% of those so employed remain unarmed. That doesn't mean that special units don't exist. They do. But they only account for about 4% of the force. They're given specialized training and, when deployed, are heavily armed. The rationale against arming street cops? Approachability. They figure the message should be that police are not the enemy. According to Smith's report, quote, The police in England and in Wales only fired 7 bullets in the 12 months up to March 2016, and in a survey of officers in 2017, the Police Federation of England and Wales found that only 33% were in favor of routinely arming officers, end quote. But they also live in a different world than we Americans do. In the United States, according to the FBI and the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, around 100 to 140 police officers are killed in the line of duty each year. Of those, 40 to 65 are killed by gunfire. Of course, guns are much more prevalent here than they are in the United Kingdom. According to the Commonwealth Fund and Brady United, the U.S. gun death rate is 26 times higher than other high-income countries. We usually rack up about 45,000 to 48,000 firearm deaths annually. That works out to something like 13 to 14 deaths per 100,000 people. In the UK, that number is somewhere between 0.04 and 0.2 per 100,000 people. The Shepherd's Bush murders, regardless of their failure to change the political will in that country to alter judicial sentencing, did move the Metropolitan Police to create its firearms unit, which is considered elite by any country's standards. Criminologist Robottom again.
It had a huge impact on the police. They have never forgotten, never forgiven.
As importantly, the Shepherd's Bush case saw the inception of something that later became known as the Police Dependents' Trust. Public contribution to support the families of Fox, Head, and Womwell came to £1 million in 1966 pounds. It did not end there. To date, more than 7,000 beneficiaries have been gifted with more than £45 million to, in some small way, compensate the spouses and children of those who died in the line of duty. So, what happened to the bad guys in this case? John Duddy died in prison on February 8, 1981. Jack Whitney was released in 1991, which you might note was not the full extent of his 30-year sentence. 8 years later, he was beaten to death with a hammer by his roommate, a heroin addict. Harry Roberts became one of Britain's longest-serving inmates. In that time, he attempted to escape 22 times and was once aided by his mother, who managed to successfully smuggle in some bolt cutters. Nevertheless, after serving 48 years in the high-security Little Hay Prison in Cambridgeshire, Roberts was granted parole in November of 2014. He was 78. The news did not go over well. Here's Steve White, chairman of the Police Federation of Great Britain and Wales.
I have to say that I've had a lot of angry officers up and down the country telling me about their dismay and anger at Harry Roberts' pending release. I think it's quite shocking, to be honest. It's a betrayal.
In another interview with Britain's Channel 5 News, White added,
"There is only one sentence for the crime of murder, and that is life. Life should mean life, full stop, regardless of who is murdered. If life isn't going to mean life, don't call it life. Call it something else. Harry Roberts needs to stay in jail."
The resistance to Roberts' release might not have been purely about vengeance, though. There was genuine concern about the message it would send, particularly given that Roberts had become something of a cult figure among certain anti-authority groups over the decades. A disturbing football chant, sung to the tune of "London Bridge is Falling Down," had echoed through British stadiums for years. I found a drunken rendition on YouTube. Releasing Harry Roberts, some feared, would only embolden those who saw the man as some kind of folk hero rather than the murderer he was. But Roberts insisted he had changed. Here's Ian Woods reporting for Sky News.
In an interview he gave a decade ago to Jason Bonetto of The Independent, Roberts said, "I don't want to be Harry Roberts the cop killer. The media talk as if the shootings were yesterday. This keeps alive this image of me as a 30-year-old cop killer. I'm not that person anymore. When does punishment become vengeance? I feel my treatment has turned into institutionalized vengeance.
Once out, he was placed in sheltered accommodations for his own safety. Roberts died December 13th, 2025. He was 89. That meant he lived 48 years longer than Jeffrey Fox, 59 years longer than Christopher Head, and 64 years longer than David Womwell. A memorial stands today on Braybrook Street, on the site where they breathed their last. To report and write this episode, journalist Amy Wilson read Nick Russell Pavier's The Shepherd's Bush Murders, Harry Roberts and the Crime That Shook Britain. She also read about it in Great Cases of Scotland Yard and in several British newspaper accounts of the crime. In addition, she also spent a fair amount of time shocked at the comparative national gun death statistics she found. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod, and you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.